Everyone, we will go ahead and call the Wednesday, May 15th Rules Committee meeting to order. And Madam Secretary, will you call the roll?
Senators Bates. Bates here. Monning. Roth. Roth here. Wilk. Atkins.
Here.
Atkins here.
And for the members of the public who are here, Senator Monning is on his way. Senator Wilk is absent today. I think we're going to hold on doing a consent calendar until Mr. Monning is here. It might be easier that way, and it's not a big deal. So, because we have appointees, governor's appointees ready to present. So I'm going to go ahead and invite Ms. Minor, and I am hoping it's Sharif.
Yes.
Okay, up. These are commissioners on the Board of Parole Hearings, and they're going to come up together. And I will ask Ms. Minor for you to start, and then we'll turn it over to you, Mr. Sharif. Feel free to introduce anyone that's with you that you want to acknowledge, because it's their moment to shine. And then go right into your opening statement if you have one, and then we will let each of you do that. And then we will go to senators as it relates to comments and questions. And let the record reflect that Mr. Monning has joined us, and we will do the consent calendar after this. Welcome.
Thank you. I would like to introduce Michael Minor here. He's with me today. And I also have my dear friend Elizabeth Siggins, who's here with us today. And also Chief, our Executive Officer, Jennifer Schaefer, has also joined us today with the And I think our chief counsel, Jennifer Neal, is also joining us today. Good afternoon, Madam Chair Atkins and senators. For the past 34 years, I have proudly served as a public servant, starting my career at Juvenile Hall, before moving to the state system with the California Youth Authority, now the Division of Juvenile Justice. After 20 years of working with youth, I transferred to adult corrections. I've been a commissioner on the Board of Parole Hearings since 2014. I'd like to thank you for your consideration today, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sharif.
Thank you. My parents aren't here today. My family aren't here, but my parents are here in spirit. So good afternoon, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, senators. My name is Excel Sharif, and I thank you for considering my confirmation of appointment as commissioner for Board of Parole Hearings. I also want to thank the Executive Officer, Ms. Jennifer Schaefer, the Chief Counsel, Ms. Jennifer Neal, Chief Deputy Commissioner, Ms. Rhonda Skipperdota, the Associate Chief, Ali Zerinam, along with the additional Associate Chiefs. But lastly, the backbone of the Board of Parole Hearings, the support staff, and the amazing Administrative Law Judges, Deputy Commissioners, that I work alongside. I bring to this position nearly 20 years of experience in the public and private sector. Before I was appointed as commissioner, I had the honor to serve as Administrative Law Judge, Deputy Commissioner for the Board of Parole Hearings, wherein I worked alongside some of the most dedicated and knowledgeable legal minds in California. Prior to that, I was in private practice and held numerous hearing officers' positions. My background and expertise have given me a great deal of knowledge and expertise in this area as well, and I place great value in public safety, teamwork, and empathy. Thank you for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. We will move into comments of the Rules Committee members. Mr. Roth, Senator Roth, I'm going to start with you, if that's okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Congratulations to both of you. You know, we have a variety of rehabilitative programs available to folks in our prison system, and we're very interested as electeds in those rehabilitation programs and the effectiveness of them. In your capacities, which of the rehabilitation programs have you found to be most effective?
I'll begin by stating the victims awareness programs, because a lot of times the inmates aren't really aware of their victims and they don't care about their victims until later on in their incarceration. And many of the victims awareness programs actually have an opportunity whereby the inmates are confronted with other victims of family victims. And when they see the empathy that the victims of the next of kin have for the inmates, they realize, number one, their harm, and also forgiveness. And that's one of the things that's part of rehabilitation, is having the inmates forgiving themselves for their crimes, and that way they can begin the process of rehabilitating.
I think many of the programs that are cognitive behavioral programs that really focus on behavior change and really changing their thinking have been really important and very effective in actually making sure that offenders are actually changing. So there are programs now that they're really focusing on changing thinking patterns, changing the way, one of the programs now that's based on cognitive behavioral therapies is the long-term offender program. And many of those programs, they have criminal thinking, which really gets to the thinking patterns that they had at the time of the crime and allows them to really reflect back on that and then really start to work on changing that thinking, which then will change their behavior. So I think a lot of the programs that focus on behavior change are quite effective.
And you're in the parole business, so obviously we're interested in trying to ensure that people who are in that situation are given the tools necessary to succeed in life and move on past, perhaps past mistakes. How effective is CDCR in providing support services to those individuals who are on parole in terms of allowing them to reenter society? Are you in a position to make a statement on that?
Well, I am, in because I was a deputy commissioner for many years, and I also dealt with parole violators. And so I saw the support services that they had in the community with regards to continuing programming, and that's what's needed. They have the programming inside the institution, but once they're released, it has to continue on because their rehabilitation has to continue. Because just like the saying, once an addict, always an addict, they have to make sure that they're aware of their issues and also make sure the program is still there in their lives moving on.
And one of the things that we as commissioners have statutory authority to do is impose special conditions on parole. So what we can do is say we're going to release this person with these special conditions, and we can impose conditions that include extra programming. We can request that they, or we can order that they go to, possibly like a 52-week batterer's course, or continue their AA in recovery, be in transitional housing for 6 months, 9 months, a year, to make sure that transition, they get that assistance that's provided in transitional housing. So we have the statutory authority to then order extra or special conditions so that it really assists them as they reintegrate into society.
Are special conditions imposed very often?
I probably have not had a hearing that I didn't impose a special condition of parole.
Same here, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you for your responses. Congratulations. I look forward to moving your confirmations at the appropriate point.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Senator Bates, let me go to you.
Well, let me add my congratulations to your appointment, and thank you. You're both in my office earlier today, and it was a very, very informative discussion, and I commend you for your commitment and your passion for doing this very, very difficult job and giving people hopefully another chance if they deserve it, and I know you take that very seriously. We did have a little discussion about the structured decision-making framework that you recently had the training for, and as I mentioned to you then, there were concerns about this and actually how it is used in the hearing process. The LAO raised some issues about the funding of it based on them not having that much information. You certainly did in our conversation, so sharing it with us a moment here I think would be very helpful in how it's applied.
So just to start, most people, when they think of the structured decision-making tool, they think of it as an algorithm as far as having us determine grant whether we're going to grant the inmate or we're going to keep the inmate in prison. It's not like that. It simply is a tool to help the deputy commissioner and commissioner calibrate to come to a conclusion as far as what are the risk factors and what are the issues that we should be focused on. Not simply talking about the life crime, which is static, but actually focusing on the risk to this particular inmate and to focus the hearing upon just simply that and not the actual life crime itself, but focus on offender change. And has this offender actually changed?
So the tool that we use has numerous domains, and in each one of those domains, we go through each one, and we're really looking at risk for reoffense based on research. And so we go through each domain, and at the end, the domains may say, like, for example, criminal history. This inmate might have had an extensive criminal history with their crimes being very close in proximity, you know, one right after another. We may say that's aggravated, and we go through the domains, and then based on that information, then we know, okay, at the very beginning of his life, this is what was going on with him. We're now 25 years later. Has there been change? And we really focus on the change. We still have discretion. It's not this check system and you know numbers and then this equals that. It is focused on these are the highest risk factors for this inmate and has he resolved them? And if he has, we then make some determinations based on some conversation, evidence in the record, things that we've reviewed on whether or not we think he is suitable for parole.
Thank you. And thank you. I certainly don't have any other questions, but again, congratulations and very impressive resumes that you both bring to us. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Senator Monning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to add my congratulations to both of you and perhaps more importantly, our thanks for your service to the state of California. I think I'll start with Mr. Sharif. We discussed earlier a little bit the challenge of conducting a parole hearing when there are victims or family members of victims participating in the process. You shared with me a little bit how you approach creating a foundation and a context, and if you could just share that with us, how you do that balancing act to afford respect to victims and their families.
Absolutely. At the onset of the hearing, I meet with the victims or the victim's next of kin, and I let them know, number one, the format of the hearing, and also that it's a possibility that this could be a grant. And if it is a grant, they're afforded the opportunity to not come back inside the room, and because I don't want them to be upset and actually relive this trauma once again. I also let them know the law as far as what are our standards and what are we looking at as far as whether or not this inmate should be found suitable for parole. And if he or she meet those standards, I have to follow the law and grant this person or deny this person. And so I want to set the framework up so that the victims or the victims next of kin understand, number one, what we're doing and why we're doing it, and not to be sort of blindsided, so to speak. But I want them to be, number one, feel comfortable in the room, and number one, also be heard. That's very important.
For Ms. Minor, we discussed some. My question went to different prisons having different programs available, from maybe a lot of programs to maybe not so many. And I found your response to that question, if you could share what role you think that plays and how that affects or not what you're looking for during a parole hearing.
So I programming is really important, but sometimes programming is not available. And there are men and women who really take the initiative to really identify what things needed to change, and they do self-study, they go to the library, they really get into information that really assists them in their change. And so they may not be in a formalized program, they may start a program, there's in-building programs that inmates start in which there may not be AA available, but they know the 12 steps and they know how to work them, so they get together on their own and they start to work those steps so that they can work on their recovery. And so sometimes when programs are not available, they take the initiative to find things that will assist them, or even get other documents from, or you know, some of the lessons from programs that other offenders are in, and they can use that program to that program information to work on their change. And so sometimes we would really like a lot of them to be able to get into additional programs, but when there are no programs available, many of the inmates have found ways to really work on their change.
Thank you. And I think you'd also pointed out that just checking boxes of having taken a program doesn't necessarily satisfy what you're looking for in terms of does the person really manifest reform and change?
So certainly we can see, you know, the inmate can come in and tell us they've changed. And then we can look at their record. We could look at information in their C file and see that that's not the case. Their behavior hasn't changed because there may be rule violation reports that tell us that. They may say that they've, you know, really tried in school, but the teacher may provide a document that said that he doesn't participate in his education. Or so there's different ways to find out whether or not they are participating, that they are changing, and that their change is real. Many of the men that are changing do a lot of service. They give back to other inmates. Men that would have and women that may have never been of service are now in prisons as gold coats, and that's inmates that are helping other inmates that are ill. Some of them work in hospice programs. Some of them are pushers, where they push the other inmates that are in wheelchairs. And so when you see those chronos, you see that there's been some change. Mm-hmm. And that maybe and that the change that they're talking about is real.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both. You're both manifest a great dedication to your work and a thoroughness, and I'll be happy to support your confirmation at the appropriate time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Monning. Let me ask, and I want to thank you both for being here. I think in past Rules Committee hearings on this, I know we've had an opportunity to see you before, Ms. Minor. This is incredibly hard work, I think, and that has to be acknowledged again. In your time, because you actually had a career at CDCR, and now you've been doing this a number of years, in terms of assessment of, and my colleagues have gotten to it in terms of the programs and readiness, do you see recommendations that should be made to CDCR as it relates to any other issue? And I know that's a difficult question to be put in your way, but in terms of the rehabilitation programs, the services provided to try to get inmates ready that may be a little different than, you know, school, education, I'm trying to find a way to see if there are improvements that need to be made within the system. And you get to be at the end of the system, but you've been, in terms of people ready for consideration and granted parole, but you've also been in the institution. So anything you would like to share?
I think that really seeing additional rehabilitative programs that are available to a bigger number of inmates would be helpful. I think the type of programming, really focusing, or maybe even additional programming that is cognitive behavioral therapy programming would be helpful. Many times we go to facilities and they're really rich in programs, and then we go to programs, I mean, facilities that are not so rich in programs. I'd like to see all the facilities be rich in program. So that we can really start to see more offender change, because these offenders are going to, many of them are going to be back in our communities. So
can you hazard a guess as to why some are rich in programs and others are not?
I don't have the answer to that. I'm not sure. I mean, you think about a place like San Quentin, and San Quentin has a lot of volunteers. And so there's a lot of people in that area that give a lot of time to that prison, and they're engaged in, you know, some of the programs are that we hear a lot about are provided by the volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to why, but I do know that when you go to facilities that have a lot of offender programming, the hearings are quite different. They're talking change. Everybody seems to really embrace change, and even the officers. Mm-hmm. You know, even the officers have a different way of interacting. And so I think if we could just infuse the system with programs, it'd be great.
So let me direct my comment here to actually staff of the Rules Committee and those who help us prepare questions for appointees. When we get to the CDCR appointments for administrators, secretaries, et cetera, that's a question we need to ask, why some programs seem to be richer and in terms of various services and programs. I appreciate your helping us with this. For some of us that have been sitting here for a couple of years, not a lot, I mean, the expertise is right out there. As I look at governor's staff who have worked very hard to fill these appointments, they're not easy appointments to fill, to find the right kind of person with the right kind of demeanor, with the right kind of skills. And so I think my colleagues and I continually try to figure out how to improve upon the largest prison system in the world and to get it right. And you're a key piece of that in terms of what you provide us and feedback, because we're not there. I mean, other than I think Senator Bates, who has training in social work, and of course our mediator down there, and I have an attorney, two attorneys, maybe I'm the only one without the experience to gauge this. But I think we're trying to look at the system from every piece, given the challenges we have. So I appreciate that. Mr. Sharif, I would ask you, you're relatively new, but not really. What is the most, surprising thing you have learned in your time? I mean, you were a deputy commissioner, and now this appointment, you've been doing it for at least a year, 2 years?
I've been a deputy commissioner for about a year and a few months, and a commissioner for 6 months.
Okay, so a couple years. Enough to gauge what you're most surprised at in terms of what you have to deal with versus what you thought.
And just to follow up also, I was inmate counsel for close to 15 years as well. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of understand from all sides of the table. One of the things that surprised me was the schedule, the grueling schedule. And you're constantly at work 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. And if you do not want this job, this is not a good job for you. But if you enjoy helping others and being of service, this is the right job for you. And I'm a glutton for punishment. I just have to say that. It's like everything I do, I challenge myself. And this job is a huge challenge. But like I was telling Senator Manning, it's not about me. This job is not about me. This job is about helping others. And so although this is a very grueling job, it's a very rewarding job as well. When I come home on Friday evenings, I'm exhausted, but I'm so satisfied. Mm-hmm. So satisfied. And enough just to get me going again for the following week, because we are helping others. We're helping others. And so that's why I enjoy this job.
And I appreciate, because clearly you must enjoy the job. It isn't just the pay, because I'm not sure you get, I don't even want to know what your minimum wage is, given what you just said to me. So I appreciate the commitment and the passion. In terms of training, I asked this last time, we wanted to make sure that there was adequate training provided as it related to the diversity of the inmates, including transgender, gender nonconforming, others. Did you get training?
We have training as a deputy commissioner and commissioner. I spoke with staff attorney for at least 3 hours just on transgender issues alone. Mm-hmm. And we also had additional training a few months ago in transgender in issues as well. And so we have a lot of training in that area, a lot.
And implicit bias is included?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
In terms of the training you get regularly. And do you have, I don't know, given, have you had experiences with transgender or gender nonconforming?
Absolutely. As a private attorney, I represented a young woman who was accused of murder and upon another transgender woman. Mm-hmm. And that was my first actual experience of the whole transgender community. And so I had to be educated by my client about the transgender community because I was so far removed. And so I was additionally trained when I came to the board because there was so much, I didn't know about non-binary. There were so many issues I had no idea about. And so we had a lot of excellent training.
Mr. Sharif, I'm a member of the LGBTQ community, and trust me, you are not alone. We are learning every day, and I'm concerned about, our prison system is overwhelmed with needs and issues that need to be addressed. Facilities need resources, the programs, and it is hard to keep up with a changing world. And so we have heard concerns from the community and people who have come out of prison in terms of the issues and needs within. And you will see pieces of legislation come forward that try to address issues around housing and safety and all kinds of things. But I don't know that we're, I think we've got some work to do there. So anything you want to add in terms of any case? Have you heard from any, either of you actually, Ms. Minor, because you've been there quite a while, of gender nonconforming or a population or community that feels like they've been targeted for any reason within the system? Has any of that kind of made its way into the cases that you're looking at as you're considering?
Just as a last follow-up, I did have a case where the inmate was a transgender woman, and I had to remind inmate counsel to call her by her proper pronoun, because inmate counsel kept saying he. And at the onset of the hearing, I made sure I asked, how do you want to be referred to, and what by what name? Because she actually changed her name as well. And so I acknowledged her CDC name, but then on her record, I only called her by the name that she wanted to be called. But I have to make sure that I reminded everyone in the room to use the proper pronouns.
Now, hopefully those regulations related to the bill I did on name change will be forthcoming. But I appreciate the time you're helping me to have a look inside and understand what you're dealing with. I agree with my colleagues. I appreciate your time and your comments. I'm going to ask, did you want to respond on that, Ms. Minor? I'm sorry. I didn't.
So I have conducted a couple of hearings on transgender females, and in one particular case, what I ran into was really having to take a really good look at the rule violation reports that along the prison, you know, the time in which the inmate was in prison. And really what I found was that there was a point in time where there may have been more victimization than violence on the behalf of the inmate. And so I had to really take a good look at why did this happen, and was this person, was she being victimized? And we determined, just based on reading the rule violation reports, that it was not that this person was a violent person. It was that the person was being victimized, and the way the information was being provided kind of didn't tell the full story until we did a deeper dive. And so I do know that we take a bit of care when we're looking at behavior and what happened. And we're just not looking at, oh, this is a rule violation, therefore you are dangerous. We're looking at what was really going on. Were you being victimized? And was this right at the time of your transition and change? And we really are mindful of taking that extra time to make sure that we address those issues. And then not an aggravating factor. Because a lot of times we say rule violations for violence equals, you know, you're going to be violent in the community, but that is not always the case.
Well, that was helpful. Thank you. Okay, let me see if there are members of the public here in support.
Did you already tell me?
I got it. Members in opposition of the public who are here. Okay, that's good. Mr. Senator Roth. Okay, thank you. And we are going to split the, absolutely. We're going to, let me go back to my agenda. We are going to split A and B. And Senator Bates, which one did you want to comment on? A or B?
Is it B? Yes.
Mr. Sharif? Okay.
Mr. Sharif, yes.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead? I'll take a motion on item A. And Madam Secretary, call the roll.
Senators Bates?
Aye.
Bates, aye. Monning?
Aye.
Monning, aye. Roth?
Aye.
Roth, aye. Wilk? Atkins?
Aye.
Atkins, aye.
Thank you. That is 4-0 with an absence. Congratulations. Senator, thank you very much. So on item number B, Madam Secretary.
Senators Bates?
Comment, if I might.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to abstain today. I intend to support Mr. Sharif when I'm on the floor. We had a few questions, and our members did not have enough time to really vet that. After my meeting with him in my office and his comments today, I am totally very supportive, but I think I have to respect my co-members not here today. And there were a few of the victims, witness groups that wanted to have a little more information. So I will be advocating for you, I guess, when we get there. But today I will abstain.
Senator, thank you for that.
Senators Monning?
Aye.
Monning, aye. Roth?
Aye.
Roth, aye. Wilk? Atkins?
Aye.
Atkins, aye.
That is good. Congratulations. 3-0, or 3-1-0. And we want to thank you for your time and your commitment to this. And thank you for giving us a little bit more insight. We do appreciate it and the job that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here for this. We are going to go back to a consent agenda. That would be governor's appointees, item 2, not required to appear, Ms. Dr. Yip. Item number 3, bill referrals. Item 4, there is a rule waiver request from Senator Mitchell. And then floor acknowledgments, items 5 and 6. That is the consent agenda, if someone would like to move it. Thank you, Senator Bates. Madam Secretary, call the roll.
Senators Bates?
Aye.
Bates, aye. Monning?
Aye.
Monning, aye. Roth?
Aye.
Roth, aye. Wilk? Atkins?
Aye.
Atkins, aye.
Consent agenda passes 4-0 with Mr. Wilk absent. And that is the extent of our business today, so our meeting is adjourned.
Half hour here?